You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, February 23rd, 2016. My name is Michael Brooks, and this is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, independent journalist, formerly of the Trans Africa Forum, Bill Fletcher Jr. will join us to talk about his piece, Bernie and the movement building beyond and including the Bernie Sanders campaign. Also, what role is Africa playing in 2016? We'll get to that with him. There's elections in Iran on Friday. Going to do a little review of that, explain to you what's going on. Also, Ben Carson is still in the race, which means I still have a little bit more time where I can do my impression of him. I can't keep missing these opportunities unless Donald Trump picks him as his vice presidential running mate, which would be the best of all worlds. Please do that, Donald. I'm sure you will, because it would be a tremendous and fantastic choice. Why baby boomers don't get the Bernie Sanders phenomenon. There's some interesting economics behind that. Interesting sociology behind that. And we have John Kasich talking about his secret weapon, woman coming out of a certain part of the House to back his campaign. Jeb Bush is out. Everybody talked about this on Monday. I'm going to probably give my perspective on that as well. And President Obama is going to give another push to close down Guantanamo. We'll touch on that as well. Not sure there's much new in the plan. It seems like another moral push for a Congress that certainly does not have any apparent intention of doing anything about Guantanamo. But we will touch on that. And much more. Course, your calls and IMs and the fun half. I was out yesterday. Sam's last check for me didn't clear, so I wasn't able to get back from Massachusetts. No, unfortunately, I had a really, really, really bad migraine, and I get those sometimes. And I'm not even joking. If I don't know, I probably shouldn't say this, but if people actually have ideas, like they have like newfangled remedies or whatever, and they want to email me at majorityreporters@gmail.com. I spoke to a doctor about it a while ago, and, you know, they said, yeah, get more rest. I mean, I don't get them very often, but let me tell you, when I get them, whew, it's crazy. So I hope nobody else who's listening has to go through them. How is everybody else doing?
Matt is great.
Is this a new like third person thing you're doing?
It is, yeah.
Matt is great.
Right.
I agree.
All right, Kelly co-signs. How is Kelly?
Pretty like mediocre.
All right, well, everybody seems happy on the outside, and obviously all that matters are the appearances. So we will be right back with Bill Fletcher Jr. We're going to talk about Bernie and the movement on the Majority Report. We'll be right back.
Rockstar, watch my pillow. Rockstar,
Rex one was my pillar, could not find place for sleep. But them empty, we have to find food for it. Every day we terrorize by sweat police. When the thing that
welcome back to the Majority Report. I am Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Bill Fletcher Jr. He is a talk show host, writer, and activist, and charismatic dude around town. Bill, how you doing?
I'm doing great, and I love the intro.
Really, really glad to have you on. Let's start. You wrote a piece for The Jacobin called Bernie and the Movement, and we've been talking about the election a lot, obviously, on this show. What I liked about your piece is you're orienting a bigger conversation around this campaign and what it could mean. And I think that when you look at the history of these insurgencies and you compare it specifically to Jesse Jackson's campaigns in the 80s, which I was not active in. I was more active in the, I don't even know, like the baby formula market or something when those campaigns were going on. But I do know that my mother actually voted for Jesse Jackson, so I have some reference point for that. But the point is that how does this campaign fit into building a larger movement or not? So that's the sort of bigger picture piece of your article in The Jacobin. And you start with a conversation that you had with Bernie Sanders in the late 80s at Harvard. So why don't you start by talking about that conversation and how it sort of frames this exploration of Bernie Sanders and movement building?
Well, so first of all, thanks again for having me on. It's an interesting question. It's something I hadn't thought about a lot, Michael, for a while. But what happened was in the aftermath of the Jackson campaign of 1988, which was in many ways very transformative, there was a crisis in the ranks of Jackson supporters in the Rainbow when, in March of 1989, Jackson decided to restructure the Rainbow in a way that took it away from what we had all been promised.
This was the Rainbow Coalition, just to be
clear.
Yes,
the National Rainbow Coalition.
Okay, yep.
And he took it in the direction, it was supposed to be a broad-based, democratic, with a small d, organization that would operate inside and outside of the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically flipped it in the direction of being an organization that was incredibly top-down and was more of a personal organization of his and his supporters. So, there was a crisis, and it was in that context that I spoke with Bernie Sanders. He happened to be at Harvard, and I was living in the Boston area at the time, and he was like a visiting fellow. So I went to speak with him, because I wanted to talk with him about the idea of a strategic convening of progressives to talk about a national electoral strategy. And the discussion I had with Sanders was very, very pleasant. And he was not in the least bit condescending. He was, I believe, at that point deciding about his congressional run. It was very engaging,
mm-hmm.
but as I say in the article, he did not indicate any interest in moving in the direction that I was proposing, and I thought about that at different points, and then I completely forgot about it until I was asked by Jacobin to write this book review that you mentioned, Harry Jaffe's Why Bernie Sanders Matters.
Mm-hmm.
It was at that point that I realized how significant it was that he, in fact, chose not to take that step. That's not who he is. He is not someone who is building organization. He is a tribune. He is an orator. He is someone who is, in many ways, a pathbreaker. But he's not someone that is truly a movement builder.
Mm-hmm.
He's a movement exciter. He's something along those lines. And that was the conclusion that I came to, which led me at the end of that article to basically say that the meeting that I asked Sanders to convene still needs to be convened.
Yes.
But I'm not looking to Sanders to do it.
Right. So let's move backwards on that a little bit, and there's some questions around that. So you made the point, and there's a couple of different aspects to this. That's the sort of macro view of your article. And it's an interesting time because, as you say, Jesse Jackson, in some ways, let's go back to his campaigns for a moment. You said in some respects that Jesse Jackson did maybe a little bit more of an effective job than Bernie Sanders in sort of building outreach across a really broad coalition. And this sort of comes up in this conversation around, does Bernie Sanders sort of focus too relentlessly on the economic justice message? How fluent is he in other issues? I think that there's some legitimate criticisms there. I also think some of them are really disingenuous and overblown from some people, but that's sort of for another conversation. But you said that Jesse Jackson basically built bases inside many different movements when he was running in the 80s, so that he had a fluency on arms control, on human rights in Latin America. He was talking about negotiating with the PLO when no one else would even touch that on the Middle East in the 80s, as well as obviously a message of economic justice and overcoming entrenched racism and brutality in the United States. So that he in some ways was sort of activating this coalition maybe even more effectively in a certain sense than Sanders. But then at the same time, what was the decision process of him when you said that he sort of used that buildup to create what you call the top-down versus democratic organization? How did that process come apart?
Wow. Well, so first of all, I would say that I actually believe that the Jackson campaign was a more exciting campaign than the Sanders campaign and a more inclusive campaign than the Sanders campaign. Now, it's interesting, the Jackson campaign emerges as a result of a black-led electoral upsurge that basically starts in the cities, like in the late 70s, early 80s. But when Jackson runs initially for president in 84 and then in the 88 election, it's not a black power candidacy. In other words, Jackson made a strategic decision that he wasn't simply running as a black voice in the national electoral arena. He was running a very progressive campaign that was suggesting the necessity to transform the United States. And as you said, what was what I found fascinating in it, two of the things, is that A, it was inclusive. So it was fairly easy for people to get involved. And there was a desire on the part of the campaign to draw various people in the development of policy and in the development of organization, et cetera. That was really striking. But the other thing was that Jackson went beyond his traditional bases. He went beyond the black community. And he's an incredibly brilliant man who takes information, he absorbs it like a sponge, and then is able to turn it into a story. And he was able to talk with farmers in Kansas, white farmers, or white workers in Jay, Maine, who were on strike or wherever. He would talk with different populations, and he was able to integrate their story into a larger narrative in a way that did not feel in any way condescending. It didn't feel like it was an add-on. Like, here's my story, and oh yeah, by the way, you guys are being screwed. No, it wasn't anything like that. It was much more taking their situation and integrating it into an overall narrative. Mm-hmm. I thought he was masterful of it at that. Mm-hmm. The problem that, one of the big problems, I think fundamental to what ends up happening in 1989, is that Jackson misread what was going on as a result of his candidacy. And he believed that a Jackson wing of the Democratic Party had been built and consolidated, And then what starts to happen is that the Democratic Party establishment reaches out to him and attempts to convince him that the best course of action for him is to basically come into the fold,
right?
Which means restructuring the rainbow, in effect. And Jackson seems to have gone for that, from what I can tell. And then in March 1989, there's an executive board of the rainbow, and these changes are announced, which essentially killed the rainbow. Now, there were a few rainbows that resisted the change. One of the most important, interestingly, was Vermont.
Hmm.
The Vermont Rainbow Coalition, led by a woman named Ella David Friedman, who remains an incredible activist, she and other people resisted the national effort, and they continued on, and their organization evolved into a statewide party. There were a couple of other efforts, including in New Jersey, but by and large, things were closed down. And I think that there are several lessons you can draw from that. One is that elections do not necessarily result in ongoing political organizations. And when you have an election, by definition, is focused around an individual. And that individual has an amazing amount of authority and control over what the process is. And when you're in an election, you're building a very broad front of people who may not like each other, but who are invested for whatever reason in the victory of that particular candidate. The other thing about elections is that they're time limited. So at a certain point, they simply end, and you don't have to look at these people that you don't like. Well, that means that when you're actually thinking about building an ongoing organization, to focus it or on building it based on an election can result in major problems. The Progressive Democrats of America, for example, came out of the Kucinich campaign. They had been led to believe in 2004, I guess it was, that Kucinich was going to build an ongoing movement. Well, after his campaign for the presidency, he went in a different direction, and people were thrown for a loop, which is what led them, many of them, to decide they had to form something right away, and that ended up being Progressive Democrats of America, which I don't think that they would have formed in that way had they anticipated that Kucinich was going to change his mind. So I think when people talk about Sanders, mm-hmm. building something to last, I think, no. I don't think that's the thing that we should focus on. I think we should assume that he will not. I think it's a question then of what will progressives do, the progressives that have become mobilized around Sanders and hopefully around local races.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point. I also, just as a really brief digression to amplify your point, this is a really kind of funny, random story, and it actually really changes a lot because it involves Bill Cosby. But where I grew up, my family actually left New York and went to rural Western Massachusetts. And in the late 80s, and as I say, I obviously don't really have any memory of this, Bill Cosby had relocated to this town in Shelburne, which is a really little town, but close to UMass, where he was getting, I think, a PhD at the time.
That's right.
And campaigned for Jesse Jackson. So Jesse Jackson came to this little tiny Massachusetts town, which did have some kind of like hippies who had left the cities, like my parents, but also a lot of real old school Yankees who, you know, literally them shaking hands with Jesse Jackson might actually have been like the first interaction they had with a black person. That's like literally possible. And he swept the town, and there's a photo of him. There was a photo of him with Bill Cosby and the police chief. So there was these like really funny and interesting things that emerged from the campaign to just sort of amplify what you're saying. I guess the other distinction, though, that I'm interested in drawing is, I think that, first of all, you know, and I know people in the audience are very excited. A lot of people are very excited about Bernie, and this primary is still ongoing, and it's a tough road for him. But in another sense, you know, They basically tied in Iowa. He won a massive victory in New Hampshire, and she won a, you know, Hillary won a solid victory in Nevada, but by no means a blowout. And he did start to reverse those numbers amongst Hispanics. But the other distinction is, and I want your thoughts on this, is it seems to me that what Jesse Jackson was doing, and maybe sort of tabling Kucinich, because I respect his crusade, but it didn't really, you know, unlike Jackson and unlike Sanders, that campaign, you know, Kucinich never won a state. He never polled really strongly. But Jackson and Sanders both are running, you know, Jackson ran to win.
That's right.
And Sanders, as you say, too, you made this point as well, Sanders is running to win. Mm-hmm. Jackson was running in a time where we still had the conservative ascendancy of America, and mm-hmm. the demographics were, you know, very skewed towards the right. And then, of course, you know, when the Democrats won back the White House in 1992, we had the full sort of neoliberalization of the Democratic Party, which, again, I think did sort of another fascinating fallout of the Jackson campaign is it's like it includes people like you, organizers, journalists, intellectuals, radicals, and there are also people who went on to, you know, become lobbyists for, you know, various corporations and really sort of, you know, join that establishment. What's happening with Sanders is that it's a campaign whose success, I think, is driven in many ways by he is actually a very appealing and effective politician in his way. But it's also the result of the complete exhaustion with neoliberalism that is much more broadly felt. It's felt amongst young people because they bear a very strong brunt of it with student loans and all the rest. The different nature of even going into professional jobs versus the baby boomers is very different. So that Jackson was pushing against the current in an incredible way and speaking for people who didn't have a voice in this onslaught of abuse and state violence that they were getting. Sanders is speaking now to something that I think is much more broadly felt. So it almost could be as simple as, you know, if a young Hispanic candidate is running for state Senate in Nevada and says, I'm the Sanders candidate, people know what that means. And they know that it means an actual stance against inequality and for justice. So there is that sort of, it's not the mechanics of organizing, but it does have that effect, maybe in a broader way.
Oh, a very interesting point. And I would say, yes, in general, I'd agree with you. I would make a slight modification in that even though you're right about the conservative ascendancy in the 80s, I think that what's important and what was important about what Jackson was doing is that there were huge populations that were being crushed as this conservative ascendancy was moving forward that were not self-aware. They saw themselves isolated, whether it was the black community or was these family farmers in the Midwest. And what Jackson was able to do was to say, no, you're not by yourself. You're not by yourself. There's actually something much bigger afoot here. Now, why that's relevant to today has to do with the weakness, I think, of Sanders. That I think your description is absolutely right, that there's a broad-based crushing of people that is happening as a result of neoliberal globalization, about which people are much more aware than they were even 10 years ago.
Right.
And Sanders is speaking to that. The problem, though, is that I think he is speaking to it in a fairly narrow way. Mm-hmm. And so he is harping on themes that he has been raising for more than 30 years. Now, I'm not against consistency, Michael. Don't get me wrong. But I think that what I feel is missing is what I was saying earlier about what Jackson was so successful at doing, of integrating the narratives.
Right, right.
So when you're talking about what's happening now, one of the things that you have to talk about, it seems to me, is that we have increasing numbers of people that are never going to have full-time work. And that is particularly, though not exclusively, concentrated in communities of color.
Right.
We have situations where there are workers that are losing jobs, for example, in West Virginia, in the coal industry, as that industry must change and eventually be eliminated. But there's no one that's looking out for those workers.
Mm-hmm.
There's no one that's saying, no, wait a minute, yes, we do need to get you out of the coal industry, but we also have to create employment so that we're not just simply kicking you into the dustbin of history. And it's those specific things, and I'm leaving out issues like foreign policy for now, but it's like those specific things that need to be part of this narrative. That's what Jackson was good at.
It seems like almost an emotional intelligence, actually, that you're...
I'm sorry?
It seems like almost an emotional intelligence, almost, that you're talking about. Yeah.
That's exactly right. I think Sanders is comfortable with his storyline.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's very comfortable with it. And I think that what you just said about Jackson, about a kind of emotional intelligence, yes. I mean, I would put a dollar to a donut that if you had Jackson out on the speech circuit now in a campaign, that in supporting Sanders, that he would be able to tell the story much, much better than Sanders is. And I think that the result is a strategic problem for Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
That is that many black voters look at him cautiously. They're not anti-Sanders.
Right.
But there's this irony, and it's an irony that a lot of people don't seem to want to talk about, which is that even though Sanders is to the left of Clinton...
Well to the left, yeah.
That Hillary Clinton is much more comfortable, almost fluid, with language around race and gender than Sanders is.
But is the paradox of that... I'm sorry, I mean, complete your thought. And then I'll ask,
Go ahead. That's fine.
Is the paradox of that, though, because it seems to me, I talked recently with a guy named Benjamin Dixon, who's a young black web host and sort of in a similar space to the Majority Report, and you know, from that sort of more millennial perspective, and his kind of frame is that, you know, this is like everything else, like, you know, there's no secret that there's a certain type of establishment across the line that has been sort of co-opted by the Democratic elite. And so therefore, it's not a surprise that a lot of members of the Congressional Black Caucus and everything else will line up behind Hillary Clinton. But she's not really speaking to these structural issues in any type of rigorous and intellectually consistent way. And I guess what's interesting to me in light of that conversation is you're talking about this incredible integrative job that Jesse Jackson did. And it's actually something that, frankly, that ability to kind of synthesize and speak, I think there's an ability that, you know, Jesse Jackson ran an incredibly progressive campaigns, but I think Bill Clinton has that ability. I think Barack Obama has that ability. And they're obviously much more centrist kind of neoliberal politicians than Jesse Jackson was. So how does it feel teasing this paradox that Bernie Sanders has these legitimate limits that need to be critiqued and solved in order to get where we want to go in his campaign and beyond? But then at the same time, this certain fluency is being used to advance a much more objectively right-wing agenda.
Okay, so this is the $64,000 question you're asking. Mm-hmm. And I think that what we have to start at is that the gentleman you were describing that was giving his point of view, I think he's only touching on one part of the issue. In other words, the fact that the black political establishment is overall pro-Clinton is not what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because the black political establishment, for the most part, was pro-Clinton in 2008
right.
until Obama was able to demonstrate at the base that he had real traction.
Right.
And so the issue of the black political establishment is not something I'm really focusing on, which is not to dismiss your friend's point of view, but it's just that that's different. What I'm talking about is that is what the second part of what you said, that there's a fluency that Clinton has that when she talks about race, for example, the Charleston massacre took place and she jumped out to speak on that. Jumped out, got plenty of press coverage. I had a discussion with people in the Sanders campaign, and I said, well, like, where was the senator? And they said, well, he issued a statement. I said, well, that's really good to know, but here's the thing.
Right.
I'm an activist. I read constantly. I didn't see the statement. So if I didn't see it, what does that mean, right? Mm-hmm. They didn't have a response. See, I think that the root of the problem that you're identifying is both personal, i.e. about Sanders and the way he thinks, and it is strategic, that is, in terms of how the campaign has come together. So let me start with the second thing. I think that the campaign made a very, very big mistake, in the beginning, in that what they didn't do was to consolidate a core that was sufficiently diverse and rooted in these major social struggles and communities.
Those are the base areas that Jesse Jackson had.
That's right.
Okay.
I mean, one of the things that Jackson did was that you had very quickly all of these different constituencies that were mobilized for him, but you also had in the where the strategy was being set, you had people coming out of these constituencies. You had people that knew farmers, for example, that were very involved in making the strategy. It wasn't like some boy from New York who has read something about a farm and knows how to eat a tomato that comes up with a theory about how to organize farmers. You had people that were out of the farm movement, right? So I think that when the Sanders campaign was coming together, there was, from everything that I can tell, there was limited recon in terms of these other social movements, and they didn't sufficiently tap into progressive forces in those communities that would have logically supported Sanders. So when they jumped out, then what happens is this odd situation, which is that Sanders takes off like a whirlwind. At that point, my read is that the Sanders campaign became dizzy with success. And they didn't feel the need to address this challenge that I'm pointing out. Now, you add on to that, in one of the debates, Democratic debates, Sanders is asked the question, why didn't he have greater support among African Americans? And his response so troubled me that I wanted to throw the blanket over my head and hide. He said, well, when people get to know me better, then I'm sure that things are going to change. And I looked and I screamed at the television. I said, no, that's not the answer. That is not the answer. The answer is not about people getting to know you. It's about you getting to know these social struggles in these communities. It's about these social struggles and communities perceiving you to believe an agent of change, a champion. And that means you, Senator Sanders, going, sitting down with leaders and not simply selling them on you, but listening to what they say, listening to their stories, and building up a level of confidence That's the kind of thing that really needed to happen before he announced.
Yeah, you know, so these points are really well taken, and I actually feel corrected in some of the things that I've said about this campaign in listening to you. But I guess my only pushback, I feel like we can index 2 points here, and this is a really interesting thing to look at. So on one hand, there are these certain strategic shortcomings, and I think, you know, to be honest, I think there I can understand the basic strategic appeal of let's just have a class-based coalition to overcome the establishment. I mean, I get the appeal of that, and I think there's a lot of truth in it, because also, on the other hand, the campaign of a, you know, grouchy mid-70s Jewish socialist has been doing pretty well. But then on the other hand, I think that distinction of, and again, it's that issue of almost like emotional intelligence, of the desire to reach out, to listen, to engage, to incorporate, that has been a little bit more flat-footed. Although, again, I think that his sincerity on these issues is very deep. The frustrating thing from an electoral point of view, though, has been watching, you know, this... Again, the campaign, the Clinton campaign, sort of utilized those weaknesses and some of those communication strengths to sort of hook around an agenda that, again, is objectively not as strong. I mean, you know, it's sort of like so I think we get into this situation where we're, you know, rightly critiquing Sanders on these issues where he's really falling short, but then in an odd way, it's sort of reverberating and benefiting the campaign that, you know, maybe is just a little bit more cynical and effective about these things.
But let me give you something. Yeah. This is going to sound really bizarre. I'm a historian. I thought about this morning. After the Civil War, there was a developing trade union movement in the United States. And one of the leading forces was a federation, essentially. It was called the National Labor Union. Mm-hmm. And it was basically white workers. And these white workers were, for a variety of reasons, very angry with the Republican Party, the party of Abraham Lincoln. And they approached African Americans and basically said, you need to leave the Republican Party and join us as we form something different, right?
Right.
And the black workers were basically saying, but why should we do that? What is it that you're going to do when it comes to our situation that gives us comfort? And they said, well, we're not going to worry about that because there are issues around which we, you know, things that we share in common, and that's what will bring us together. And basically, black folks said, nah, that's not the way it works. Hmm. And this is a theme that keeps coming up in history. And it's what I'm critical of the campaign, the Sanders campaign, for not appreciating that the idea that we simply unite around those things that we have in common, right, is not enough when you have this demonstrable differential in treatment for many of us of color. So that's... Right. That's like sort of point number one. But the thing about the Clintons is that their relationship, and it doesn't always feel completely rational, but their relationship, their ability to feel comfortable among black people, all of these things, their ability to speak about our issues when so many white politicians refuse to, mm-hmm. is for many people attractive. I'm not justifying it. I'm just saying that's the reality. Mm-hmm. So at this point in time, it would have seemed to me that the Sanders campaign would have woken up, smelled the coffee, and realized that they've got to do something different. And doing something different isn't simply about talking about the importance of fighting racism. Mm-hmm. It really is, where do you find yourself? What communities do you go to visit? Mm-hmm. What leaders do you sit down with and talk with? How do you embrace their stories? Because it's not going to be enough for Sanders simply to go to Harlem or go to East LA or go to a Native American reservation and talk about economic inequality and why we should rally around his flag. people there have to feel, particularly when you're dealing with what is in effect an insurgent campaign, they've got to feel some level of, well, yes, you hear me. I know you do hear me now. And I'm willing to invest some time in this campaign because I really do believe that you get me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the burden is higher, absolutely. And I'm reminded there's this concept I came across once of, like, I think it was like community without unity, in the sense that, like, how do you build across all these divides but recognize that you can't have unity in some respects, at least the way this person was using unity, because we can't sort of pretend that these differences don't exist. So we need to come together and recognize that we're apart at the same time and then build coalitions around that. It was an interesting concept. As a final thought, we'll get to Africa next time.
Yes.
Who's gonna convene this meeting? Is it going to be you, Bill Fletcher?
I'd love to be part of convening it. And let me explain why. Because I've actually, in all seriousness, been talking to different people about the need for it. I believe that the right wing convened this meeting, a similar meeting,
yes,
in the late 60s.
Yes.
And
we've talked about it a lot on the show, definitely.
Shortly
a lot of these
after
meetings.
The Goldwater
yep.
campaign.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Right. And they looked at a map of the United States, and they started figuring out how to construct a strategy that was on three different levels: electoral, mass movements, and legal. And they engaged the struggle over the decades while many of us were asleep at the switch. I think that we have to have that meeting that looks at those three areas, mass movements, electoral politics, and legal challenges. And then we have to start asking some questions that go way beyond how do we win the next presidential race,
mm-hmm.
but really how do we win power for progressive people in Texas?
Right.
You know, I mean, how really? I mean, just let's like look at the map. Texas will be in play. That's pretty much clear. But the question is, how do we win in the state legislature in Texas? What do we have to do? What kind of organizations need to be built? And what happens for many progressives is that we don't seem to have the patience for that. Mm. We either get swept up by someone's campaign at election time, or we think that we can avoid elections and simply engage in mass organizing. And I'm saying that we need to be developing a strategy that looks at all three areas and looks at it over a period of 1 to 2 decades.
Well, I'm looking forward to my invite. I'll be
that's
there.
Right. I'll hope you'll be there, definitely.
Absolutely. Bill Fletcher Jr., I really look forward to talking with you again soon on and off air. I appreciate your time today. The piece in The Jacobin is Bernie and the Movement. There's a link to it on our website. Bill, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Take care, then.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right, everybody. We are going to go to the fun half.
Can I say before that?
Of course.
I had just been thinking this weekend that I want to hear more about this, the political revolution side of Bernie Sanders' campaign thing. So I think this is a very timely guest, and I thank you, Michael, for booking it.
Thank you. Bill Fletcher, a very, very smart dude, and really, really worth reading always. You can become a member of the Majority Report today at majority.fm/become a member. It's less than a cup of coffee a day, and it allows this show to exist. It allows that conversation to exist. It allows Right Wing Mandela to exist. The full range. I haven't done my Right Wing Mandela for Bill Fletcher Jr. yet. I did Right Wing Mandela. There's a guy, Milton Alamadi, who we haven't had on the show for a while. He publishes Black Star News, and he's a really interesting Ugandan journalist. And we met on a TV thing together, and I did Right Wing Mandela for him. I played him a clip because I kind of wanted that sign off. He thought it was hilarious. You can support this show at justcoffee.coop. Get the Majority Report blend, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. It's a win for everybody, the workers, the environment, the socially responsible business, the co-op economy, and us. Write us a review on iTunes. Give us 5 stars. Write us a review. It helps get us in front of more eyeballs. If you're a member of the show, subscribe to us on iTunes at the same time. It will not in any way affect your members' feed, but it will help us climb up the rankings, which, you know, matters again because more people see the show. Follow us on Twitter if you're on Twitter at majority.fm. Like us on Facebook. That's The Majority Report on Facebook. We're posting a lot more content up there now, and that's much more active. It's a great way of bringing new people into the show and starting arguments with your conservative friends on Facebook, if you have them, and just generally spreading good propaganda. Excuse me. I'm sorry, Lynn. I know we don't do propaganda. Join us in this. What else? Is there anything else I'm missing? Okay. Join us 646-257, 646-257. See you in the fun half. 246-657-3920. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.